Welcome to Cato Audio for April 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. In this month's offering, Jonah Goldberg talks about the risks of nationalism and identity politics. Mustafa Akyol talks about liberty and Islam. Congressman Jason Chaffetz explains the risks of stingrays, the latest in domestic eavesdropping. And Robert Bradley talks about a classical liberal energy policy. First up, this month's Cato Roundtable. As the Cato Institute this year marks its 40th year, it's important to take a moment to focus on one issue that maybe wasn't in the public discussion as much as it is today, in part because of Cato's efforts, and that is monetary policy. And today we're talking with George Selgin, director of the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute, and Jim Dorn, VP for Monetary Studies and editor of the Cato Journal, both with books out or soon to be out from the Cato Institute in their respective areas. George Selgin's book is Money, Free and Unfree, and Jim Dorn's book is Monetary Alternatives, Rethinking Government Fiat Money. And both, as of this recording, ought to be available to you right now. So, gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So let's talk about, you know, going back to I don't know, where would you like to start? I mean, obviously, Cato started in 1977, but let's talk about where was monetary policy discussion? What was it as robust as it is now, or was it simply people not really questioning the actions of the Federal Reserve?
Well, we've had quite a swing, as George mentioned in the foreword to my book, Alternatives to Government Fiat Money. There was a lot of discussion about rules versus discretion, but then after that, most of the attention was on controlling interest rates and on discretionary fiat money. Cato brought into existence a wider discussion because not only did we discuss monetary alternatives, that is, alternatives to the government fiat money system, but we discussed a rules-based system all the way from the gold standard or free banking with a gold-based currency or even private currencies without gold, as Hayek promoted, for example, to limiting the Federal Reserve, the central bank, by some type of a monetary rule like a price stability rule or nominal GDP. So we really brought about a more robust discussion of limiting the power of government, including limiting the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve has gained substantial power, but it has little humility. And we had people like Charlie Plosser and other people talk about the limits of monetary policy, that monetary policy can't do everything. It can't stimulate economic growth over the long run and so on. So we brought those arguments to bear within our own concept of limited government and free markets.
When Cato was first founded, of course, there was a lot of discussion about monetary policy, all related to the inflation at the time. And there was also a very poor understanding of the role that the Federal Reserve and central banks played in causing inflation. And I think the early Cato work in that area helped to contribute to a better understanding of the monetary causes of inflation. But after that, after Paul Volcker brought the inflation rate down, we had the Great Moderation period, and people became very complacent about monetary policy. They thought, oh, well, the Fed's finally solved everything, everything's good, don't need to talk about that anymore. And the same was true more or less abroad, where other central banks also seemed to have gotten their sea legs. But of course, the crisis has changed everything. Cato never stopped talking about the need for fundamental reform. I don't think that we ever were convinced that the Fed had figured everything out or that other central banks had. And now we are pushing harder than ever to get people to think about the need for fundamental institutional reform that can bring us truly lasting stability in our monetary systems.
And yet we have arguments with people like Ken Rogoff, Jim, you and I had talked about previously, who think the number one problem with money, it seems, is that the central bank doesn't have enough control.
That's right. I mean, economists are talking about getting rid of cash, for example. They made a movement in that direction in India, although they introduced new paper currencies. But they've done it in Venezuela and other places. And Ken Rogoff would like to see negative interest rates being used by the Fed. And, of course, negative interest rates would push people into cash since they can't get any yield on their deposits at the bank. So he wants to basically not outlaw all cash, but big notes. And that would give people fewer options, obviously. And he thinks that would give central banks, certainly give them more power, but also more control over the money supply and so forth. And I think that's extremely dangerous position to take, that people have the right to hold cash. That's part of their bundle of property rights. And when the government comes in and removes that right by force, that diminishes economic freedom.
You know, I think Rogoff's ideas, in a way, represent a natural culmination of conventional thinking about money. It reminds me of Milton Friedman's quip that if you put the government in charge of the Sahara Desert, eventually there'd be a sand shortage. And sure enough, we put governments in charge of supplying our paper currency, and now they're talking about not supplying it anymore. Of course, my own research and some of Jim's as well has been about how it's been a big mistake to take the management and provision of currency, not just paper currency, but all sorts of currency out of the private sector and to hand it to government. And if we end up with no currency at all or only very limited amounts, that's, in a way, what we should have expected to happen all along with this reliance on government.
You know, a couple of years ago, I went to Hong Kong with my wife and was sort of startled, first, that their denominations are referred to as honkies, but also that—
That comes, by the way, from the not from Hong Kong, but from the Honkers and Shankers, which is the nickname for the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, one of the main private note-issuing banks in Hong Kong.
Well, and on the currency is printed the logo of HSBC.
That's correct.
And, you know, I don't know what their relationship is with the government precisely, but at least as a conceptual matter, you look at it and you see, oh— There's really at least no particular problem with having a specific corporate entity sponsor money.
That's exactly right. Of course, George has done a lot of research on that with the Scottish banking system and so forth. But I think this idea to outlaw cash could backfire because people will want a parallel currency and they can go into digital currencies, for example, like Bitcoin or some other currency that may emerge. So we basically favor parallel currencies and competition in currency because we don't want the government to have a monopoly over such an important aspect of people's lives.
Okay. And Jim, as we've spoken before, India is probably a prime example of what happens when you tell people they can't have cash.
Absolutely. And I'm amazed that Modi won by such a large vote in this recent election in Uttar Pradesh, which is one of the largest states within India.
So if you could both provide me your perspective on, with respect to India specifically, this seems to be a case study in when you give political actors too much control over the money supply. What practically allows political people to engage in that kind of a policy?
We have to be very careful, though. The problem, the specific thing that went wrong in India was that they decided to demonetize their existing currency notes before they had the new ones ready. So strictly speaking, the plan wasn't to just get rid of cash in that case. It was to replace it. Or at least to modify the cash, and that meant turning in all the notes, and particularly the smaller, some larger denomination ones. And they botched it. They simply botched it. And they knew they were about to botch it because they knew the new currency wasn't ready, but they did it anyway. And they discovered in this way just how heavily dependent their economy was on cash, highly cash-dependent economy. Now, people like Rogoff will say, well, it's a whole different story here if the Fed bans, particularly if it bans $100 notes or hundreds and fifties. You know, we have checks, we have other ways of making payments. One thing, not the only thing, that that argument neglects is that just as India's reform, botched as it was, mainly hurt the poorest people in Indian society, the U.S. ban on a U.S. ban on larger denomination notes would also hurt large numbers of poor people. And I don't just mean poor people in the United States. That's not the important problem. Our dollars, our large bills, are used extensively abroad, and they're not just used by criminals. They're saved by people who live in countries with depreciating or untrustworthy currencies. They are widely used in all kinds of perfectly legitimate transactions, and I mean legitimate from the points of view of the governments in question. It would be an absolute thrashing of many innocent poor people to get rid of the high denomination bills that that we supply, and that means it would do at least as much, or perhaps even more damage than India's botched reform did, and this must not be overlooked.
Now, you talked about perfectly legitimate transactions and the poor people around the world who could be harmed. I'm thinking of Ecuador, where they're essentially a dollar-based monetary system.
That's right. And so is Panama, and so are some other countries, either officially or unofficially. And they would have to, of course, completely revamp their systems and perhaps turn to establishing central banks, which they have resisted doing. Well, Ecuador is a different case where it introduced a parallel currency. But in any event, the problem is that these countries know very well that their central banks are not trustworthy, or that central banks in poorer countries especially tend to become engines of inflation. So we'd be forcing them down a route that many have been fortunate to avoid taking or have escaped taking, escaped from fairly recently. That's not going to do anybody in those countries any good at all.
And the other thing, Caleb, is that Rogoff and others that want to replace cash use the argument that, well, this will get rid of corruption, black markets and so forth, shadow markets in India with respect to drug dealing and everything else and underground payments. Well, that's nonsense because in India especially, the black markets have emerged because of government restrictions on economic freedom and the need for licenses and all these other things that people want to get around. And the big dealers in these know how to get rid of cash quickly. They don't stay in the local currency. They might go into gold or dollars or some other thing to protect their situation. So simply issuing new currency to replace the old, and then they're issuing new currency to replace the old currency, so they're still going to have paper currency. They're just, you know, they took the 500 rupee note out and the 1,000 rupee note, which were very large denomination notes in that culture, and they removed about 90% of the cash. And it created a chaotic situation that still hasn't been thoroughly resolved. But I think what people are reacting to and the reason they're voting for Modi is because he's promising to get rid of corruption. And in fact, the government itself is the one that's generating the corruption because of the lack of economic freedom.
Well, and one man's crime is another man's economic freedom, right? Depending on whether or not you're charged with enforcing the rules against what is in broadly understood to be a perfectly legitimate transaction. But the more broadly than that, cash and the availability of parallel currencies, as you explain, serves a function that allows people to get around bad rules.
Right.
And allows them to, in some ways, escape a regime that otherwise might have even more power over their lives.
Yeah, it increases the range of individual choice, which is really the measure of development to a large extent, as Peter Bauer pointed out. so that when you limit the opportunities to hold cash and you impose costs on people by making them move to different currencies, that has a negative impact on the society.
You might call it the new serfdom, because in the old manorial system, of course, serfs or whatever you choose to call them, they provided services in kind to the lords, and the lords supposedly provided them with services in turn, protection, what have you. And what the monetization of medieval economies did, as many people recognized, was to provide a means of escape from that those feudal bounds and allow the serfs to become wage earners and to be able to buy their services wherever they liked instead of being bound to the manor. Now, well, it's a different kind of servitude to be able to trace every transaction that people undertake and then tell them which ones they cannot or arrest them if they undertake the wrong ones. I think it's in many respects retrograde.
So as I mentioned earlier, the honkies, as they were called, are these sort of plastic pieces of material that are the notes. They are bank notes in a very real sense from HSBC. So what would I need to understand about how those notes come into existence in order to appreciate whether or not this is a sound monetary regime?
Well, the first thing I would emphasize is that once upon a time, all the paper currency that people used came from private commercial banks, some of which had special privileges, but they were nevertheless private banks. The Bank of England, for example, was a private bank for most of its existence. In Hong Kong, you had one of those cases where multiple banks competed to supply notes, which were just promises to pay that circulated, and they raised funds from people. They collected savings that way in the same way that they collect savings by taking deposits. The Hong Kong system now, like all of the few surviving competitive banknote systems, the others are in Ireland and Scotland, is heavily regulated with high, essentially 100% marginal reserve requirements. But back in the past, banks issued notes based on very modest reserves, and the countries that had the freest banking systems, which gets us back to talking about Scotland, which Larry White has written a definitive book about, and Canada, but also Hong Kong in its earlier days, they had the most effective, stable, and efficient banking systems. And we forget just how stable and efficient they were, with very few losses, very few failures, and very few crises.
And of course, those systems had a money that was convertible into some type of a commodity. And the book that I had produced with articles from the Cato Journal over the years is focusing on alternatives to government fiat money, not just government fiat money, but discretionary government fiat money. So we live in a pure fiat money world today. There's no link to any commodity at all. It's not convertible. So it requires that the central banks limit the quantity of money. But how do they know how much money to produce? Under a commodity-based system with convertibility, the supply of money basically is determined by the demand for balances for trade and so forth. And money holds its value over the longer period of time. There's a equilibrium built into that system. Now we have a system that nobody knows exactly what the Fed's going to do. There's a great amount of uncertainty in the system. There's no rules behind the system, no rule of law. And I think that's a very poor system, and we have to think about the institutional features for improving that system.
So what were the big lessons for our money when it comes to the financial crisis? In our various conversations in the past over this, we saw a dramatic increase in the Fed's balance sheet, a lot of assumption of authorities that were dubious at best by the Federal Reserve. But what would you say were the sort of the linchpin lessons that we should be taking away for our money from the financial crisis?
Well, I would add, in answering that question to what Jim was saying before, there were actually there are two features to these old, really sound currency systems I was referring to, and they went together very well in the past, but they should be recognized separately. On the one hand, yes, in those old days you had commodity standards, particularly in the last decades of the 19th and early decades of the 20th century, you had gold standards. But you also had in the most stable countries, and this is important because not all countries were stable that had gold standards, but those that were, like Canada, had currency systems managed by competing banks supplying paper currency as substitutes for gold. And that structure of the banking system, the freedom of those banking systems to establish branches, to convert deposits into currency and so on, which was a freedom that was utterly lacking in most other, in many other countries, including the U.S. We had lots of banks, but having lots of banks and having a free banking system are not the same thing. In any event, that the combination gave Canada a crisis-free system, and people don't realize America had huge financial crises before the Fed, which is why we ended up with the Fed. We had panics, 1884, 1893, 1907. They seemed to get worse and worse. Canada, nothing, hardly anything happened. Most of those years, nothing happened. They never had stringencies, let alone full-blown crises. They had some trouble in 1907 because the government regulations, one of the few regulations, limited Canada's bank's ability to issue notes, and they had to relax that, and that took care of that. And totally crisis-free. In the U.S., the crises were severe, but let's keep in mind they had a gold standard. Now, one of the lessons of this is that whatever the flaws of the gold standard are, right, we have to separate them from the flaws that are connected to particular banking systems. So if there was instability in the gold standard, if we want to know how much that was its fault, we need to look at the systems that were most stable because we don't want to blame the gold standard for the banking problems. On the other hand, we can have a banking system like Canada's, in theory, without a gold standard. It will help. It won't make up for the botches of the botching up of monetary policy of central banks, but it could make for a much more efficient system. And by the way, it's worth mentioning, though it's been a long time since the good old days of completely free banking in Canada, that Canada weathered the recent crisis extremely well compared to other countries, and that too reflected well on its banking system, which continued to have at least some of the features that it had in the old free banking days.
And I would point out that the Federal Reserve as we have it today is much different than when it first started in 1913. Its powers are quite a bit different, and it's involved in macroprudential regulation. It's using a situation with respect to the crisis to expand its power, and it used quantitative easing, which was involved large-scale asset purchases. They were purchasing mortgage-backed securities, allocating credit, and doing all these things that the original central bank never did. And in addition, this whole dual mandate is misleading because the Fed really can't bring about real economic growth. Printing more money doesn't create real economic growth. It creates distortions in prices, and the Fed tries to control interest rates and leads to all types of distortions, penalizing savers by near zero interest rates. So its policy of quantitative easing and also near zero interest rates have distorted the economic system and led to a situation of pseudo-wealth creation rather than real wealth creation.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to leave that conversation there. But if you'd like to dig down a little more into these issues, you can get Jim Dorn's book, Monetary Alternatives, Rethinking Government Fiat Money, with essays by Jeff Lacker, Charles Plosser, George Selgin, a tough get, I'm sure, Leland Yeager, and, of course, the late Jim Buchanan. And the other book, Money, Free and Unfree, which comes out this month with some contributions from Lawrence H. White and Bill Estraps, that book, of course, by George Selgin. And if you want to learn more about a monetary policy, you can, of course, tune in to the monetary conference that the Cato Institute has held for decades now. And, of course, find more at our website, cato.org. Nationalism and identity politics deny, or at the very least minimize, the importance of the individual by reducing everyone to categories. Combined with populism, these forces can create unique risks to liberty. Jonah Goldberg, senior editor at National Review, discussed the challenges at a Cato seminar in Florida in February.
Globally and in America, we're in a very strange moment. We're in a moment of populism and nationalism, the likes of which we have not seen in a very long time. And I'll just be honest, I don't like populism. The conservatism that I grew up with, which is got a heavy dose of libertarianism in it, is all about the idea that ideas matter, that arguments matter, that facts matter, that feelings don't. If you feel that it's triggering that 2 + 2 = 4, does it mean 2 + 2 isn't 4? And what populism basically says that if enough angry people get together, they can say 2 + 2 is whatever they want it to be, 5, 10, a duck, doesn't matter. And I remember one of my favorite lines comes from William Jennings Bryan, who was one of the most famous populist leaders in American history. And he said, "The people of Nebraska are for free silver. Therefore, I am for free silver. I will look up the arguments later." My view is, no, the arguments matter. If socialized medicine is bad when Democrats want to put it in, socialized medicine is bad when Republicans want to put it in. And I'm not a team guy. And I think this has disappointed a lot of people who thought, you know, one of the most shocking revelations of this entire period has been how many people have been disappointed in me for not living down to their expectations and becoming sort of a party hack for them. The only populist movement I have ever supported, and I supported it, I spoke at rallies and all the rest, was the Tea Party movement. The Tea Party movement is the first populist movement I can think of in American history where the whole idea was to fulfill that ancient biblical libertarian prophecy of libertarians taking over the government and then leaving everybody alone. And I thought the Tea Party movement was an incredibly healthy thing, because what it was the exact right response to Barack Obama, which was, let's double down, reaffirm our core convictions about limited government, constitutionalism, living within our means, the importance, you know, of these sort of Lockean precepts that created the founding. That's what the Tea Partiers embraced and championed. The problem was, they were called racists anyway. And they were demonized in the press, and they were treated like as if they were sort of nascent fascists. And I think that one of the things that this did was it sort of caused a kind of psychic break for a lot of conservatives who said, well, we're going to get called racist no matter what. The left is all about tribalism and identity politics. Maybe we should be too. And while by no means do I think everyone who voted for Donald Trump, I have people in my family who voted for Donald Trump, I have friends who voted for Donald Trump, I get it. But there is, particularly as you get into some of the more fever swampish areas of the right that National Review has always considered itself a policeman of, there is this new embrace of sort of white identity politics. And I think identity politics, whether it's of the right or the left, is bad. And I don't believe in the principle of, if my enemy is wrong but winning, I should be wrong too so I can compete with them. And yet, there's a lot of that going around on the right. And it takes a lot of different forms. Some of it is racist. A lot of it is just sort of nationalist. But either way, I think it's dangerous and unhealthy. And I guess I should clarify about something about conservatism. So conservatism, properly understood, is different in America and always has been. Friedrich Hayek makes this point. The great social scientist Samuel Huntington has made this point. America is the one country in all of the world, with the possible exception of Britain today, where you can be a conservative and a defender of liberty. That is what Friedrich Hayek was talking about in his famous essay, Why I'm Not a Conservative. The conservatives he was talking about were the blood and soil, altar and throne conservatives of Europe, right? Monarchists, nationalists. He was not talking about America, where he said America is the one place where you can call yourself a conservative and still be on the side of liberty, because in America, what we are trying to conserve is a radical liberal constitution and founding that enshrines certain ideas in. And so when I talk about conservatism, I'm including libertarianism. And I know when I make these points at Cato, because Cato is one of the only other places where people wear their favorite philosophers on their ties because we're so cool, we can get into some arguments about it. But that's what I mean by all of this. And that brings me to nationalism. I think a little nationalism is a healthy thing. It binds people together. It makes people attached to what they know and what they have. It sort of thickens the stew of civil society. But the problem is, first of all, nationalism and patriotism are not the same thing. My old boss, William F. Buckley, liked to say, I'm as patriotic as anyone from sea to shining sea, but there's not a molecule of nationalism in me. And on the other hand, Adolf Hitler said, I'm a nationalist, but I am no patriot. There's a difference between the two things. Patriotism is, especially particularly in America, involves attaching yourself to certain creeds and ideas about the nature of the society that we live in and the kind of government that we want. Nationalism just basically says, my tribe versus your tribe, and my tribe's better. And so a little tribalism is a healthy thing because it gets people to stick together. It's what makes teams work. It's what makes all sorts of, you know, that sense of belonging is what makes army units work. That's all fine. But every poison is determined by the dose. Too much nationalism becomes lethal to a country. And I should also point out, nationalism and socialism, in terms of public policy, are the same thing. If you nationalize medicine, you're socializing healthcare. You can go through any speech by Fidel Castro or Hugo Chavez or any of those guys and just randomly swap out the word socialist for nationalist and the words nationalist for socialist, and the meaning stays the same. When you nationalize things, you socialize things. When you socialize things, you nationalize things. The days of the dream of international communism have been dead since about 1928. It's all about nationalism within states. And nationalism is the code words of the right for talking about socialism and solidarity and team and my tribe versus everybody else. And socialism is the language that the left use. But when you listen to them, you should be aware that basically they mean the same thing. They're just describing slightly different teams.
Predominantly Muslim societies suffer from low levels of political, economic, and civil liberty. Authoritarian political regimes, rigid social structures, and radical religious movements that suppress human liberty in the name of God loom large in the Muslim world. Is this liberty deficit due to a dark age of Islam? Can it be overcome? Author Mustafa Akyol made his case at the Cato Institute in February.
I'll talk about Islam, my religion, but I want to begin by recalling an episode from the history of another religion. And I want to actually recall an important philosopher from the 18th century Germany. His name was Moses Mendelssohn. And he was a pious Jew who was also inspired by the Enlightenment. He was especially driven to the rationalism and individualism and liberalism of the Enlightenment. And with his writings, he wanted to synthesize Judaism with the Enlightenment. He argued against coercion in the name of religion. He argued for reinterpreting the Halakha. He argued that Jews could be full members of Gentile society because Jews were living in ghettoized communities, partly because of European antisemitism, partly also because of rabbinical authority and the communalist culture. So he wanted to make Jews German and Frenchman, you know, of mosaic faith. He thought one can be fully Jewish and fully modern and liberal. Not everybody, though, were convinced by these arguments. Some Christians at the time thought that while Christianity is a religion of the spirit, Judaism is a religion of the law. So there's an inherent tension between Judaism and liberalism. One of those critics of Mendelssohn was a man named August Friedrich Kranz, who wrote a book against him, booklet, let's say. And he said, Judaism is an armed ecclesiastical law. It can never be compatible with liberalism. And he just wondered why Moses Mendelssohn just doesn't convert to Christianity rather than trying to just be in this futile effort of trying to reform Judaism. Another Judaism skeptic at the time was a name no less greater than Immanuel Kant, He said, while Christianity appeals to the individual, Judaism is communal, and it has an idea of theocracy in its very beginning. So he said, Jews can never be, you know, members of free European societies unless a euthanasia of Judaism comes to happen. These were 18th century debates. History proved them basically wrong, if you ask me, because Moses Mendelssohn's ideas triggered a new era in Jewish thought called the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment. And Jews gradually actually began to embrace these liberal ideas, became full members of European society. A reformed Judaism was born in the 19th century. Even Orthodox Jews reconciled themselves with certain ideas of the Haskalah. And even if there was something that really blocked Jews fully integrating into European societies, that was anti-Semitism rather than Jews' own predispositions towards, let's say, an illiberal culture. And today, when you look at the Jewish world today, you see European Western Jews as actual defenders of liberalism most of the time. And a pre-Haskalah, you know, ultra-Orthodox minority in Israel sometimes can come out with, you know, illiberal stances on gays and women and so on and so forth, but they don't define. They're becoming a more marginal force within the Jewish world. Now, why I'm speaking about Judaism? I think the reason is obvious, because the 18th century discussions about Judaism are sometimes being repeated today in the 21st century about Islam. There are Moses Mendelssohn kind of Muslims who are saying that Islam can be compatible with liberal democracy. We have to do some reinterpretation for sure, but it can be. And actually, liberal values are inherent within Islam if you understand them properly. Whereas some people are saying, wait a minute, you know, Islam is by nature a political ideology rather than a religion. It is a religion of the law, so Muslims are bound to be loyal to the Sharia, and they will want to implement Sharia wherever they are, from Indonesia to Oklahoma, you know, wherever they want. And so therefore, I think maybe the Judaism skeptics of the time were a little bit essentialist in looking at a religion and thinking that there are the certain texts and it will never change. I think I see a kind of essentialist approach to Islam as well. And the big emphasis, of course, comes from the fact that the West is defined mostly by Christian heritage, and Christianity is indeed a religion without a religious law, whereas Islam and Judaism both have tradition of religious law, halakha and sharia. So the argument is that always the other religion is exceptional, whereas Christianity is taken as the norm. But you can actually see that religions have different traditions, and actually Islam and Judaism has a lot of in common in that perspective. So we have Moses Mendelssohn of the world, Muslim world of today. So what are these people are arguing? Just let me give you a brief overview. Well, I gave the long answer in my book, Islam Without Extremes, so all the arguments are there. But to summarize, basically this actually began in the Muslim world in the 19th century with Ottoman liberals like Namık Kemal or Arab reformists like Muhammad Abduh. These were Muslim thinkers who admired a lot of the liberal values in the West, and then look at the Islamic world, they found many problems, and they thought that if you go back to the basics and reinterpret certain things, you can actually have a liberal interpretation of Islam. One emphasis in this trend is always go back to the Quran and be more critical of the jurisprudential schools of the Middle Ages, and even some of the hadiths, the words attributed to Prophet Muhammad, because a lot of the tensions between actually liberal values and Islamic jurisprudence, like banning apostasy, blasphemy, certain things on women, come from the hadith more than the Quran. So there's always a Quran-focused reformist perspective. That's one thing. The other one is to historicize Islamic resources, Islamic sources, to say that the Quran was revealed by God in the 7th century, but within the context of that century. So certain injunctions reflect that context, and today we can re-understand the Quran and the other Islamic sources within the 20th century, within the modern context. So that's another approach, which I think is very sound. There's always a desire to reform some of the lost schools, the rationalist Mu'tazila, for example. These were the Muslim thinkers who read Aristotle and reconciled it with Islam, Islamic theology, because they thought that scripture is from God, but reason is from God as well, so they should work together to find the truth, which is a different way of seeing the truth only coming from scripture, only from revelation. So that has been emphasized. My favorite liberal Islamic school of thought actually is, though, the Murji'ah, an Arabic term which means the postponers. These were early Islamic thinkers who emerged at a time when different Islamic schools were killing each other, fighting, calling each other as blasphemers. They said only God has the right to decide who's a blasphemer and who's an apostate and who's a true believer. So this issue should be postponed to afterlife to be resolved by God. That's why they were called the Murji'ah, the postponers. They made the argument that John Locke also did in his letter concerning toleration. So there are these kind of resources in Islamic tradition that can be today brought into light and used to build a liberal argument. And those arguments are there, and there are Muslims who find them persuasive. So in every Muslim society, you have these liberal Muslim movements for reform, for change, for some progress. Women's issues are always a big issue. So we have a trend called Islamic feminism. I can proudly say that my wife is one of the proponents of that. And I certainly supported her on that, just make no mistake. And Islamic feminism argues that, you know, in the beginning, Islam was a religion that liberated women. However, male domination ideology interpreted the Quran and misinterpreted for centuries. Now we can go forward. So here you have a trend. When it comes to economic freedom, actually, it's easy to make the liberal argument there. I mean, from the beginning, Islam has been a market-friendly religion. I mean, Prophet Muhammad was a merchant among the world's big founders of religion. He's the only businessman. And he left a legacy of, you know, market and trade. Interest has always been an issue, but Muslims have found ways to either not call it interest, but do it in another way, or maybe to say that there's a difference between usury and modern banking interest. So that's why, you know, you can have capitalism that is valued and accepted by Islam. Here's one thing, though. Some people will say, well, yes, we know there are Muslim liberals since the late 19th century. But they're not very popular. You know, they're always marginal. The other guys are always winning. Like, why is that the case? Is there something essential about the religion which makes this liberalism, you know, a futile effort? People sometimes ask me, like, you've been writing about this for 10 years. You know, my whole Muslim world is not like Norway still. Well, one thing is that civilizations take time to change. I mean, it takes a lot of time for Christianity to change as well. We should remember that. But the other thing is that, and I think that's particularly valid for the past two centuries of Islam, ideas flourish not in vacuum, but they flourish in a certain context. And liberalism generally flourishes when a society feels secure, when a society feels dignified, when a society feels wealthy. That's why, you know, sociologists generally connect liberalism to the rise of the bourgeois, the middle class, you know. It's not an accident that it grew in more safe societies. It is also not an accident that when traditional liberal Western societies are challenged, they feel threatened, they can move away from liberalism a little bit. I think we are seeing that trend in Europe and US lately. The Islamic world in the past two centuries saw witness this effort to bring in liberalism, but also it has been the most insecure civilization on earth in the past two centuries. The past two centuries have been the most traumatic era for Muslim societies.
If you own a cell phone, you're carrying a miniature tracking device in your pocket, a fact that law enforcement agencies are increasingly taking advantage of to investigate crimes and monitor suspected criminals. Cell site simulators, or stingrays, designed for the military but used by domestic police, make it possible. At a Cato conference on domestic surveillance in February, Republican Representative Jason Chaffetz, chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, discussed the dangers posed by stingrays.
This discussion today is very specific. to so-called stingrays. Now, I want to be careful. That's a brand name of a particular provider. There are other pieces of technology out there that do similar things. It's like calling it Kleenex when tissue would more better cover the whole gambit here. But they have been known as stingrays, but essentially cell phone simulators. You have a mobile phone. It's constantly searching for a signal. Somebody comes up with a simulated cell phone tower, a more portable device that will tap into that. And then not only can they tell your specific location, but these machines actually have the ability to read content of those machines as well. Not something that they like you to know about, but the reality is they can actually also look at content. And despite assurances that that would never be the case, these machines are still built to be able to gather that information. What the public doesn't, I think, thoroughly understand is that our federal government has spent close to $100 million buying these machines. $100 million. So just at the Department of Justice alone, and it took us a long time to unearth this, they have 310 of these devices, spending more than $71 million. The Department of Homeland Security has 124 of these devices, spending more than $24 million. And as the result of our committee's investigation, the public now knows not only do traditional law enforcement entities such as the FBI and the U.S. Marshals have these devices, but remarkably, the IRS has been purchasing these machines. In fact, they purchased one, I believe is on the East Coast. They try to tell us that they really don't use it and don't use it very often. And of course, that's the case. They bought a second machine so they could have one on the West Coast. They spent more than $1 million, basically $500,000 each for machines that they tell us they really don't use. Now, what in the world is the IRS doing with cell phone simulator technology? I don't believe Mr. Koskinen is the commissioner of the IRS. I think he has lied to the American people and the Congress. I absolutely don't trust him. And I don't trust the IRS snooping on our phones and using these machines. I don't know where. I can't see it. But they have them, and I think the public, I think they should sell them or give them back or dispose of them. And they should do that under the watchful eye of some third party, because I absolutely fundamentally do not trust them, and I see no reason for them to have this technology. When a cell phone, a cell site simulator device is activated, the cell phones in the surrounding area connect to the device in a similar way that your cell phone's towers do. Essentially, it allows the law enforcement to see your very precise location. It was described to me that if you were to go to New York City, and you had this device, not only could it tell you which building you're in, it could tell you which floor you're in, and it could tell you which room you're in. You can see in a law enforcement situation, that can be a very positive thing, right? There are good aspects to this. If you have a missing child, if you have maybe an elderly citizen who has wandered off and is forgetful, you can see where there are positive ways to use this. You can also see that in a law enforcement investigation, if they are targeting a particular criminal, they could get in there and understand and track and find this person. I think there are very legitimate reasons to do that, and there are some departments and agencies that I'm sure are supposed to be able to have these. These machines were originally designed for the United States military, and we did not dive into the military aspects of this at all. Now, when the committee first began its investigation in April of 2015, the federal law enforcement entities could obtain a court's authorization to use these simulators by meeting a standard that was lower than probable cause. In September of 2015, 5 months into the committee's investigation and with a hearing in the Subcommittee on Information Technology, literally right before our hearing, the Department of Justice announced a new policy for its cell phone simulator devices. I don't think they wanted to go to the committee without being able to articulate what it is those procedures would be. Shortly thereafter, and just 2 days before the hearing, Homeland Security also followed suit with an announcement of a similar new policy. And then shortly thereafter, the IRS said, oh, okay, well, that's our policy too. The new policy substantially changed how the agencies obtained authorization, and the policies now require agencies to obtain a search warrant supported by probable cause with some very limited exceptions. In short, the bipartisan oversight and public exposure really pushed the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and the IRS to fundamentally alter their policies and the way they're doing that. It wouldn't have happened unless there was some oversight. But as the report makes clear, when the committee initiated its investigation of spring of 2015, the use of these devices at the federal, state, and local level, it was really not very well known, and the inconsistency was certainly the case. Let's also understand that it's not just the federals, the feds that have these. You have Sunrise, Florida that has a device. And I'm sure the good people of Sunrise are very safe and secure, but they don't necessarily have to institute any standards in using these devices. Now, I think it's a violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. I think it is an invasion of our privacy. I have asked, I believe, two FBI directors and two attorneys general, I should say, you know, there's a discussion out there about metadata and content. And they'll swear to you, they'll testify, and they will say, look, we only look at the metadata. You know, when I send an email between me and this gentleman over here, we're just looking at the metadata. We don't look at the content. So the question, one of the questions we all as a society have to ask, is your geolocation metadata or is it content? I would argue that it's content. If I can watch you, where you are, where you go, what you do, who you visit, that's the content of your life. And so because I carry this mobile phone device, should everybody in the world be able to see if I'm going somewhere? What if somebody's maybe getting cancer treatments or wants to go to a particular bar or wants to just, you know, pick up their kids at a school every day? Is that anybody else's business? No. It's not, and it's certainly not the law enforcement's business unless they have probable cause to chase us down. So the FBI, which has 194 devices, took very evasive steps to obscure not only these devices from the court and the public, but it's also its role in assisting state and local law enforcement agencies. In fact, they went so far when they helped the locals to make them sign non-disclosure agreements to prohibit the public from learning about the use or role of these this technology. They even went so far in cases where there were pending criminal charges, and rather than prosecuting that person, they decided they didn't want to reveal how they knew this information, and they just dropped the case, and the bad guys, at least in their opinions, walked. And they went to great, great lengths to keep these secret, which should tell you something about these.
In the 2016 campaign, Donald Trump said that he would stop Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan, cancel the 2015 Paris Accord on greenhouse gases, and end what he called the war on coal. Now, the president says, is the time for action. What will he do regarding energy? What should he be doing? At the Cato Institute in February, Robert Bradley, founder of the Institute for Energy Research, discussed what a classical liberal energy policy might look like.
I think the first point is that free market energy policy is based on private property rights, voluntary exchange, and certainly the rule of law. There's a whole academic tradition of free market environmentalism that I won't get into here today, but I think these are the three essentials: private property, voluntary exchange, and the legal framework. Another tenet of a classical liberal free market energy policy is that government regulation and tax policy is neutral, or as neutral as it can be, avoiding special government favor, picking winners or losers. And there's a term, all of the above, when it comes to energy policy. That, to me, is code for government subsidies of some energies to allow them to compete against the energies that consumers naturally choose. Very, very much a barrier against cronyism or rent-seeking by private interests. The free market energy policy is principled. Classical liberals do not condone pro-industry regulation. One would be eminent domain for common carrier, common purchaser pipelines on the state level or on the federal level. International oil, interstate oil pipelines receive eminent domain rights if they are common carriers under current federal law. But on the state level, certainly eminent domain is important. Generally, I think you can say that free market energy policy is pro-consumer and pro-taxpayer and pro-entrepreneur in the sense of private entrepreneurship versus political entrepreneurship. There's an intellectual tradition behind classical liberal energy policy. Certainly, the idea of undesigned order, spontaneous order, the results of human action but not of human design, what we've learned from F.A. Hayek and a number of other scholars, applies to the U.S. oil and gas electricity experience. There's lots of case studies there. There's also a very rich historical tradition of government intervention in energy markets. And government intervention, as a rule, is cumulative. It's always going from one phase to the other. It is unstable, and it is even chaotic, whether it's price and allocation controls of energy resources during World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict or the 1960s and 70s, the results have been predictable. The same with protectionist programs for oil in particular in the United States from the 1930s forward. And I mention that because of the border adjustment tax that's now under consideration. I think a third point is the intellectual tradition of public choice economics, recognizing that there's government failure, not only market failure, and that any public policy in the real world that proposes to intervene in markets, not only do you need to estimate, understand the alleged market failure, you have to factor in that political solutions are expensive, there's unintended consequences, they go off in completely new directions. And this is a very powerful argument for not intervening in the first place. Not having the qualitative decision to intervene, even if it starts off very small and grows later on. And I think there's a lot of history. There's theory and history that supports a pretty much a laissez-faire energy policy.
Cato University is the Cato Institute's premier educational event of the year. This year, we've expanded Cato University into several three-day sessions, each with a different focus that offers comprehensive analyses of critical, multifaceted issues at the center of individual liberty. The first session will be Cato University's College of Economics, held in July in Newport Beach, California, with discussions by top economics professors from Harvard University, Northwestern University, and the Cato Institute to solidify your expertise on core economic issues and then help you apply those tools to today's most pressing issues. Registration and additional information for each program is available at cato.org. That will do it for this edition of Cato Audio. I'm Caleb Brown. Talk to you again next month.